listening to KBOO Portland.
In 2020, Portland saw unprecedented protests for racial justice and widespread criticism of the Portland police and the institution of policing itself. It's now been almost 3 years since over 80% of Portland voters approved changing the city charter to create a new civilian-led police oversight system. The Police Accountability Commission has been hammering out the details, and their plan goes before City Council at the end of August. Totality of Circumstances will be hosting the commissioners live on KBOO on Tuesday, July 25th, and you can call in with questions or comments about the proposal. You can also send us questions at totalityradio@gmail.com. That's totalityradio@gmail.com. Join us on July 25th from 5 to 6 p.m. and make your voice heard.
Listen to Black Book Talk at KBOO FM every first Thursday from 11:30 till noon. Co-hosts O.B. Hill, Patricia Welch, and Emma Jackson Ford discuss African-American authors and books. That's Black Book Talk every first Thursday from 11:30 till noon on KBOO FM.
This is Rising Up with Sona Ali, a weekly news and analysis program focused on economic, racial, gender justice, and more. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar, and you can find us online at risingupwithsonali.com. This week, we'll examine the impetus behind why 160,000 actors are on strike, joining their writing colleagues on the picket line. Los Angeles-based independent journalist Piper French, who's been covering Hollywood's labor woes, will be my guest. Then we'll continue our ongoing series, Realizing Reparations, of interviews conducted during the recent Alight, Align, Arise conference in Atlanta, Georgia, organized by the Decolonizing Wealth Project. Today's topic will focus on narrative change, and my guests will include Vinikia Williams of Media 2070, Trevor Smith of Liberation Ventures, and Jessica Iwuyor of the National Black Cultural Information Trust. That's coming up in just a moment. This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. Hollywood has come to a standstill this summer as actors join their writer colleagues on the picket line. The Screen Actors Guild, American Federation of Television and Radio Artists, or SAG-AFTRA, announced that it would be on strike starting July 14th over negotiations breaking down with the Alliance of Motion Picture and Television Producers, that's AMPTP, which represents most of the major studios in the film and television industry. That same body failed to negotiate in good faith with the Writers Guild of America, or WGA, which has been on strike since May 2nd. Together, writers and actors represent the majority of creative talent in the most influential film industry in the world. Among the issues at stake are streaming residuals, or royalties, and the use of artificial intelligence. My guest is Piper French, a Los Angeles-based independent writer and journalist. She's written for the New York Review of Books, the website The New Republic, The Nation, The Drift, Bolts, Lux, and the Los Angeles Review of Books. She recently wrote about the head of SAG-AFTRA in a story for The Nation entitled How Fran Drescher Went from TV Nanny to Union Boss. Welcome to the program, Piper.
Hi, Sonali. It's so great to be here. Thanks for having me.
So it wasn't terribly surprising that SAG-AFTRA would go on strike. And just to frame it for our audience, there are three major unions, not two, representing Hollywood. There's the Writers Guild, there's the Directors Guild of America, DGA, and then SAG-AFTRA. So the writers, directors, and the actors. WGA has been stuck in a strike for nearly 3 months now, but the Directors Guild actually settled and signed a new contract with AMPTP. SAG-AFTRA is now also on strike. Why do you think it's the writers and the actors? They seem to be fighting over a couple of similar issues, which is residuals and AI. They both are seemingly central issues for actors and writers, right?
Yeah, absolutely. The first question you might be asking is, why do people like Brad Pitt and Margot Robbie need to strike in the first place? You know, these are incredibly famous, wealthy individuals. The reality is that A-list actors represent only a tiny fraction of SAG-AFTRA's membership. So the union is 160,000 people strong. And to put it in context, you know, about 86% of those people do not even make enough from acting per year to qualify for the union's health insurance plan. So these are really working actors we're talking about. And yeah, there's a lot of overlap in concerns between the WGA and SAG-AFTRA. As you mentioned, you know, residuals and AI are both things that people are really focused on right now. You know, the industry has just changed so much in recent years. It's sort of impossible to overstate how much the rise of streaming has affected viewership. So people just aren't going to theaters in the way that they once were. People are watching, you know, Netflix at home, sitting on their couch. And that has also had a big impact on compensation for writers and actors, because streaming just doesn't provide as much residual checks. So the checks that you get when something you worked on airs on television again. Streaming provides a lot fewer residuals. They also hold their viewership numbers very close to the chest. So these writers and actors don't even know how popular their shows are. And so for all of those reasons, it makes sense for them both to be on strike right now. And it's actually been about, I think, 63 years since both unions were on strike at the same time. Ronald Reagan was president, not of the country, but of the Screen Actors Guild the last time this happened. So yeah, it's been a long time, but it's an exciting moment.
The issue of residuals is such an important one. And, you know, unless you're in the industry, it's not something you've really heard of. One actor that I follow on social media, Kendrick Sampson, he's, you know, an activist as well as an actor. He's often seen at Black Lives Matter protests. And he pointed out that recently he received 56 residuals checks. And he was really hoping that, you know, this was going to help him make ends meet. After he opened 50 checks, he stopped and counted how much the totals were and was $86. $86 from 50 residual checks. That means all of the shows and the movies that he's been in, every time they re-air, he gets a tiny bit of money. And it used to be, right, that writers and actors between jobs, because essentially everybody's freelance in the industry, between jobs would be able to make a decent living from these residual checks if their show re-aired on some of the traditional media. But now when it's on Netflix, they're not getting anything. And then sometimes to avoid paying residuals, the studios are just disappearing shows off the platforms too, right? So it's kind of shocking.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's something that's really concerning to folks, that they could work so hard on a creative endeavor. And then, you know, these companies, in order to get out of paying actors and writers sort of what they're owed, can just disappear it. Like you said, take it off the platform entirely. No one ever gets to see it again. And that's bad for viewers too, honestly.
I want to quote from a recent article in Deadline that came out just before the actors went on strike. You might have seen this. It's been getting a lot of traction because it's just so shocking. There were a number of anonymous studio executives that spoke with Deadline about the writers' strike. And what they basically said was that, quote, the end game, this is a direct quote from an unnamed studio executive, the direct quote is to allow things to drag on until union members start losing their apartments and losing their houses. One insider called it a, quote, cruel but necessary evil. Piper, how is this? Are the members of these unions pretty clear on the fact that their bosses want to break the union, want to starve them out?
Right. This story made waves because the quotes are so shocking. But, you know, it's a little hard to know the extent to which this actually reflects the beliefs of the folks who are at the negotiating table. But, you know, from people I've spoken to who are on the negotiating committee for SAG-AFTRA, the studios really won't budge. And they get the feeling that the MPTP simply doesn't care about increasing compensation for working actors. You know, their focus is really how much money can their CEOs get in bonuses at the end of the year. I think, you know, this, the fact that SAG-AFTRA has entered into the strike is a lifeline for the WGA. Folks there are really relieved. They've been on strike for almost 80 days already, and people are struggling. You know, they are not working. You know, a lot of people don't have savings might be living paycheck to paycheck. And this is tough. And, you know, now SAG-AFTRA, you know, the strike only just started, but they're facing the reality of months, potentially months of striking. No one really knows when these negotiations will continue. But it's also important to note that, you know, this is this will have an impact on the studios as well. They have stockpiled content as much as they can. Netflix in particular has a big backlog of content they're going to be rolling out. But at some point they're going to run out of content. And that means that we're all going to have to brace ourselves for, you know, a future with only reality TV on television, which is obviously something that nobody wants.
Right. Unscripted television is much cheaper. The actors, quote unquote actors, are not unionized. And that is precisely why the studios love them. So it's a matter of, it's sort of like a game of chicken. Who's going to budge first? If the actors and the writers are working paycheck to paycheck, if their resources are already stretched, the reason why they're fighting, right? And if the studios have piles of cash that they're sitting on, enough money to overcompensate their CEOs, enough money to buy each other out, because they're spending a lot of money consolidating and buying other studios, it seems as though the studios have the upper hand. If it's down to who can withstand a financial storm longest, the studios are most likely going to do it. Then it seems to me that the real fight is going to be fought in the field of public opinion. Would you agree?
I mean, I think that actors have an advantage here, which is that some of them are public figures and they're often well-liked. And they're talented at communicating. So someone like Fran Drescher, for example, is a beloved figure from network television. Having her get up there and give a really rousing speech where she's calling out the greed of these corporations, you know, that's gonna go viral. Her speech, you probably saw her speech, you know, she almost sounds like Bernie Sanders or something. They're actually meeting today, I believe. So things like that will go a long way in sort of spreading the message of this cause, I think.
So I'm so glad you brought that up, because you have written about Fran Drescher several months ago, that you, when Fran Drescher took over the leadership of SAG-AFTRA, she is somebody who was, you call her once network TV's working class darling on screen, and now she's a real life union leader. Tell me a little bit about why Fran Drescher's leadership matters. SAG-AFTRA doesn't just include actors, it includes, you know, people like me, broadcasters. But the fact that she is an actor and a well-known actor, is the leader of SAG-AFTRA, I imagine has an impact in terms of the story that's being told. How important is her leadership?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, she's the public face of the union at a moment when there's intense focus on what's happening. And so I think it is important. Fran Drescher became president of SAG-AFTRA in September of 2021. And she became president at a really fraught moment for the union. So SAG-AFTRA is actually only 11 years old. The two unions, which represented film and television workers respectively, merged in 2012. And there's a lot of disagreement sort of before and after that merger on whether it should even happen. And that's led to sort of two different political parties within the union that really butt heads on how to make decisions and how, you know, what to fight for. And there's a lot of bad blood. And so, you know, when Fran Drescher became president, there was real doubt within the union about whether she could manage to sort of unify these two really distinct political factions. But honestly, from what I've heard anyway, and of course, you know, this is a massive union, so there are going to be people, there are definitely people who are dissatisfied with her leadership, but for the most part, I've heard people be really pleasantly surprised with how she's managed to sort of forge some of these divide or bridge some of these divides. She is not seen as a really partisan person. I think she's, you know, she's really passionate about her beliefs, and but she's not someone who's going to take a side and, you know, ice other people on the opposite side out. And, you know, from what I was hearing yesterday from a source on the negotiating committee, she and Duncan Crabtree Ireland, who's the chief negotiator, are working really well together. You know, she has that fire and that passion, and she can represent the, you know, the performer's perspective. Duncan is a lawyer, he's a skilled negotiator, and he is sort of working on the business side of things. And yeah, together, I think that, you know, ultimately, it's sort of wild to say, but I think this union is actually maybe more united than it's ever been.
And one other thing that we didn't talk about in terms of the issues that are at stake, you know, there's the residuals, there's a huge, huge issue. And then there's the existential threat of AI. This is a really central one. SAG-AFTRA released a letter that was very critical of and, you know, made it clear that this is an issue that they can't budge on. Can you distill for our audience what the fight over artificial intelligence is with Hollywood? And that's a huge issue even outside Hollywood these days, right? So what's the clash between AI and SAG-AFTRA?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we've all been hearing about ChatGPT over the past few months. You know, this is a really pivotal moment for the use of AI in every industry. For SAG-AFTRA specifically, I think the fear is that, well, you know, they're arguing that what the AMPTP is trying to do is basically sit a performer down, scan their entire likeness, hand them half a day's wages and say, here you go. And then they can use that person's image in perpetuity without their consent and without any compensation. And that's something that could really change the entire model of the, it could render actors obsolete essentially. And so this is something that is pretty non-negotiable for SAG-AFTRA, I believe. They are not against the use of AI like in general, but what they want is consent and compensation. So they want to make sure that the performer is looped in about how their likeness is going to be used so that they can actually opt out if they're not comfortable with some aspect of it. And they also want to make sure that that person gets compensated anytime their likeness is used, just like they would, you know, if, for example, a TV show that they were in aired again.
And so whether the, you know, this is all part of the AMPTP wanting to cut costs, right? So you have this huge drive by these industry, by this industry, by the studio executives to try to lower their costs and maximize their profits. The CEOs, which now there's a lot of sort of social media sharing of the salaries, the compensation packages of these, you know, CEOs like Disney CEO Bob Iger, who is, you know, who's been photographed lounging on his super yacht while actors and writers are out picketing. There's much being made of the fact that they are essentially driving down costs as much as they can at the expense of people in the industry while maximizing profits. But they are turning around and saying that the writers and actors don't really understand that their strike is coming at a bad time for the industry, that the pandemic really hurt the bottom lines of the industry, and that by these union members making their demands, they're being unreasonable. The timing is bad. Can you tease apart the AMPTP's line and justification?
Yeah, absolutely. That is what they're saying, that, you know, it's a tight moment for everyone, so we just need to work together. And I think that, you know, it has been a hard few years for the movies. The pandemic, you know, is such an obvious disruptor. But the response of SAG-AFTRA is that, you know, if they don't get these, the industry is constantly changing. There's new technology all the time. Streaming was just one, you know, massive shift, but there will be more shifts. AI is sort of one of those. And their feeling is if they don't, you know, sort of get the deal that they need now, then they're forfeiting any opportunity to in the future. And then also, you know, as you point out, we have these CEOs with their massive bonuses, end of year bonuses that are based on performance, and the actors are arguing, you know, we should also have a performance-based metric for residuals, which is what streaming has sort of taken away. And, you know, it's just, it's hard to make the argument that, you know, someone like Bob Iger, whose net worth is in the hundreds of millions of dollars, you know, when he's saying that the union needs to be realistic. A lot of these people who are in the union are making, you know, $10,000, $20,000, $30,000 a year and having to support themselves working second or third jobs. So there's just a big disconnect there.
I mean, you would think that if anybody could easily replace, AI could easily replace any job, I imagine that a network executive's job would be better replaced by AI than an actor's job. In fact, I believe somebody already asked ChatGPT, which would be easier to do in terms of using AI as a replacement for a job. Piper, where can people find the work that you've done? Is The Nation magazine's website a good place to read your story on Fran Drescher?
Yeah, absolutely. My story was in the print issue a few months back. It's also online, and I'll be covering the strike again, you know, this week or next week for The Nation as well.
Thank you so much for joining us, and good luck to you.
Thank you so much.
My guest is Piper French, Los Angeles-based independent writer and journalist. She recently wrote about the head of SAG-AFTRA in a story for The Nation entitled How Fran Drescher Went from TV Nanny to Union Boss. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. For those of you living in Los Angeles, I hope to see you on Wednesday night at Roman's Bookstore in Pasadena at 7 p.m., where I'll be in conversation with Luis J. Rodriguez about my new book, Rising Up, The Power of Narrative in Pursuing Racial Justice. Again, and that's a conversation about my new book, Rising Up, with Luis Rodriguez at Roman's Bookstore in Pasadena on Wednesday, July 19th at 7 p.m. More information about the book and this show is at risingupwithsonali.com. This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. Hundreds of movement leaders, activists, organizers, funders, and journalists gathered in Atlanta, Georgia in June 2023 at Alight Align Arise, an invitation-only conference on reparations organized by the Decolonizing Wealth Project. As the conference's media partner, Yes Media spoke with more than a dozen prominent organizers, activists, and leaders. Among them were Venikia Williams, campaign manager at Media 2070, and Trevor Smith, director of narrative change at Liberation Ventures, where he's building the Reparations Narrative Lab.
Hello, I'm Venikia Williams. I use she, her pronouns, and I am the campaign manager for Media 2070.
I'm Trevor Smith. I use he, him pronouns. I'm the director of narrative change at Liberation Ventures.
So the two of you are very much engaged in narrative work and narrative shifting, but you're at a conference around reparations. Tell me how the idea of reparations and narrative shifting collide, and what reparations means to someone who's engaged in narrative work?
I would say the way that they collide is that, you know, that this nation has yet to really reckon with its history. And so for so long, when you say the word reparations, you would get like a recoil. So we really have to change the narrative around reparations and really see it as a healing process as instead of something that kind of makes us recoil. So I would say that's the way in which they intersect.
Absolutely. Just to add to that, stories tell us about who we can be, who we've been. And so the story around reparations and the reparative culture that we can build, it's our job to sort of build that what's never been seen before. And so the imaginative work of dreaming up new worlds is the work that I believe we do.
Yeah.
You have also, I know, and through your past work, talked about the idea of media reparations. What are media reparations?
Yes, so media reparations, we try not to be too prescriptive, but when we talk about it, we talk about what would the world look like if Black folks were able to own their stories from ideation through creation, through distribution, and a friend of ours recently added through experience. And so what would it mean? What would it look like for ownership and control without interference of white supremacy and racial capitalism to be present and to really own those stories and to reclaim what's been stolen?
Yeah, and to me, media reparations means a lot of things. But when I think about it, I think about anti-Black narratives and the role that the media has played in creating and sustaining anti-Black narratives. And so I think, you know, I think nowadays when we think about media, we think of kind of just traditional press, but kind of the first popular media in this country were minstrel shows. And that is where we got a lot of the anti-Black stereotypes that still stick with Black people today. You know, Black people is lazy. That's a stereotype that was born through minstrel shows. And so when I hear media reparations, I think about what is the role that the media has to play in uprooting anti-Black narratives and creating a pro-Black world.
Absolutely. I would add to that, there's been the case of the myth of Black inferiority being perpetuated. And that's ever since the first newspaper was created, right? And so the technologies change, but the lie hasn't shifted much. And so it looks different with each new iteration of technology, but that myth and the anti-Black narratives remain. And so we're doing the work of undoing that and rewriting something more beautiful and more true and truly human. Right.
Media 2070, they have a great essay that details kind of the history of media and the role that they've played in creating and sustaining anti-Black harm. And they talk about how, the media profited off of slavery as well through the use of runaway slave ads. And so in thinking about reparations, I think we have to think about it holistically. Of course, the government has an important and probably the most important role to play, but there are other institutions that we also have to hold accountable in this work.
When we think about any kind of government support or reparations directly, there is the national conversation around who is deserving of help, who is deserving of welfare or benefits, and certainly I'm sure it'll come up with reparations. And so how do those anti-Black narratives that perpetuate the myth of, as you were saying, Black inferiority play into or play against reparations becoming a reality?
Yeah, I mean, they stand in a big way. And I think we see these narratives play out across our policy spaces. So I think we see it with, you know, food assistance, with SNAP, we see it with housing assistance. And then, of course, we're going to see it with reparations. You know, there's this idea that Black people are irresponsible with money. There's this idea that Black people won't be, and Ta-Nehisi Coates actually talked about this yesterday, that we would spend it irresponsibly. But that's not really the point. You know, it's something that is owed. And so I think that reparations is actually a really beautiful project because I think it is so large that it can actually uproot this idea that Black people don't know what to do with their money. They don't know how to self-govern, because I do think that sovereignty and is a really important part of the reparations conversation.
You were referencing the opening remarks by Ta-Nehisi Coates at this conference that we're meeting at, Alight, Align, Arise. And one of the other things he talked about was, well, first of all, he was like, it's none of anybody's business how people spend their money. But the other thing that I thought was so important was the portrayal of people as whole, complex human beings. He's written, you know, comic book characters and narratives in mainstream media. And how important is that aspect? Is that a huge part of the work that you do around narrative shifting, that people of color, Black people, are complex human beings with all of the dimensionality that our traditional media have just left out often of the stories?
Yes. And so Black feminists thought one of the manifestos talks about us being seen as levelly human, not as superhuman, not as less than, but being levelly human. And so when we say we want to write and access to these narratives, it's not just the ones that paint us in the best light, but in the truest sense, the ones that paint us the good, bad, and the ugly and show our full humanity. It's a reclamation of that. So I would say the complexities are the most beautiful stories.
Right. And we deserve to be superheroes. We deserve to be seen in that light. I mean, look at what we're seeing right now with the backlash with Little Mermaid. You know, I think that it's very telling as a society when we are arguing about a children's story and who should play that children's story. You know, Black people aren't even allowed to be mermaids. So I think that we need to tell full stories, whether they're fictional or non-fictional, stories of Black people. And we really deserve to be able to show up in the ways in which other communities have been able to show up in their stories.
Do you see a change, especially in the big commercial industries, the media making industries? Do you see a change because folks have infiltrated, if you will, these fought their way to the top or fought their way in the rooms where these stories are told?
I would say I've seen a change, but not enough change. And so oftentimes people want you to celebrate the one who got into the room and not all those that were left behind. There's this tokenism. There's this idea that just the one story is enough. But Media 2070 truly talks about a future that's abundant with stories. So it's not just one mermaid,
right. But
several. We can have a Spider-Man. We can have all these different stories that are being told. So it's not that the one isn't beautiful and shouldn't be celebrated, but it surely isn't enough.
Right. I think two things come to mind. I think in the midst of 2020 and the quote-unquote racial reckoning, we saw a lot of newspapers start to apologize for institutional racism. I don't think that they, you know, those apologies, I think, were welcomed, but I don't think that they went far enough. And one of the things that I would really like to see in terms of change from newspapers is different types of beats. You know, there are so many reporters who report on crime, but there aren't as many reporters who report on care or report on mutual aid, you know, all the ways in which we help each other, you know, because they're not seen as newsworthy stories. But I actually think that the way in which we care for each other is much more important to write about and to think about on a day-to-day basis than the ways in which we harm each other. And I think we actually help each other a lot more often than we harm each other. So that's one way that I'd like to see more change. And then the other thing that comes to mind is something that we're seeing more so in like sports and particularly the NBA. A lot of NBA athletes are starting to have their own podcasts. And so when we talk about ownership, I think that it's so important that the folks who are core to the story are telling the story. So a lot of NBA players are starting their own podcasts, they're starting their own media companies, LeBron James, Steph Curry. And these are the types of things that I'd like to see more from like our Black leaders, those who have access to power, those who have access to capital. These are the folks that are the ones who are going to be able to empower folks who are closer to the ground to uplift their stories. And so I love to see what I'm seeing there, and I just want to see more of it.
I'm wondering if the notion of reparations as a whole is something that you feel enough people are engaged on in a broad sense. The mass media is slowly talking about reparations. We have pieces of legislation that are being discussed. California has a task force. Do you think that there's enough media discussion of what's already out there on reparations, or is it mostly sort of grassroots social media, you know, folks on Twitter trying to engage in the conversation?
I would say no, there isn't enough. But even in what there is, it's inaccurate sometimes. And so the cherry picking that we heard about, where they're only taking pieces and parts of the story, and so what the public is then being presented with isn't a full view of what reparations can mean and what it can look like fully. And so when reporters are irresponsible, I think it's that's what it is, then you leave people being less knowledgeable about what they need. And like I mentioned before, misinformation has always been the goal. Like, they want to uphold the status quo. And so mis and disinformation is the way to do that. And so leaving out those key pieces of information that can empower the public is what's currently happening. And that's what I see.
Can you be more specific? Like, give me an example of like what are the pieces of the story around reparations that are being left out, and how is it misleading people?
So I would say some of the things around when you only see a dollar amount and you don't necessarily see how things are attributed and how they'll be allocated, when you talk about different things that can be can look like repair but aren't truly reparative, but they just label it reparations. Those are some of the things, but I wonder if you have a few more specifics.
Yeah, no, cosign 100% of that. I think, you know, I started a newsletter called Reparations Daily-ish 2 years ago, and so there is, there's enough news to start a newsletter about, and I'm just astonished. I think over the past 2 years, I've compiled hundreds and hundreds of news articles from across the globe, so it is a global conversation, but to Vanikia's point, we definitely need more, and we definitely need more accurate stories and more fuller stories. And so I think reparations is mostly seen right now through a financial lens, and the media doesn't really help in telling that fuller story. It is about the money, but it's not just about the money. You know, I often say that reparations is an economic project, but it's also a political and cultural project as well. And so I think that's the part of the story that the media is usually missing. You know, there's a psychological harm that you can't put a number to, that I always hear Black folks talk about when we talk about reparations. So it's not just about fitting reparations into the kind of current iteration of capitalism that we have. It's about changing systems. And so the media definitely misses out on that part. And then to Vanikia's other point, there are institutions or individuals who are grappling with the role that they should play in reparations, such as churches or such as white people who are the descendants of people who owned people. And that's great that they're grappling with that, but those stories need to include the voices of the grassroots organizers who are doing the work. Because oftentimes I see things that I don't know grassroots organizers would label as reparations be labeled as reparations, and to the lay person, to the average person, it's going to get confusing. And so that's why narrative is so important in this. We all have to be aligned on actually what we mean by reparations. And I think that the grassroots organizers, those who are building power at the local level, are the ones who should be included in all of these stories.
And the reparations, the idea of it has to be grounded in history, right? And history is something that we are seeing this culture war being waged against by design, especially in the last few years. Do you worry that there's just often just a lot of missing historical context that, you know, seems like it might be obvious, but really still bears repeating and needs stating? We need reparations because X, Y, and Z, you know, this nation was built on a Holocaust, et cetera. Do you feel that history is that contentious ground?
I think there definitely needs to be a learning of history and a reintroduction to it. But as important as that is, I think that's a prerequisite for the imaginative work that's also needed. We need to know where we've been to say where we're going, but people's imaginations have been dampened. And so we can't even do the work of saying what tomorrow might look like because we're worried about current day issues, right? And so I think history is a part of that, so we don't get the story twisted. But what is the new story that we're going to tell? That world building, I think, is what's truly key in this moment, especially.
World building, I'm hearing a lot more of that. So imagining the future that you want, or just spelling it out and showcasing it in some way. And you know, that is something that we see happening more and more of, but I don't think our mainstream media really have gotten on that bandwagon yet.
Well, to that point, within world building, it also includes world destroying. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Something has to be demolished, right, and cleared away. And so that's not as beautiful as a story, pretty of a picture to paint. So I think that's why we hear about it less.
Right. And I think another narrative I think that's really important as we think about like world making, world building, is what we're calling radical solidarity. And so we need, I think, all Black people, all people of color, and white people too, to build this new progressive, transformational, welcoming world that's rooted in new values. I think that narrative is so important because it relates to culture and what we value as a culture. And we are so, so, so disconnected as people. You know, we live in a world right now, in a society right now, where you can walk into a school and shoot children and nothing changes. You know, culturally, we are really, really broken. And so I think that radical solidarity is a key part of this world-making effort. And so until we can come together and see each other's humanity and like actually true humanity, you know, we're not going to be able to move this work forward.
Let's wrap up with your respective organizations. Media 2070 is what exactly? What is the magic year 2070 mean?
So the year 2070 is the year in which we've received reparations. It's real. It's beautiful. It's abundant. And our stories have full agency, like we are fully self-determined and we can fully thrive. Those stories are told without interference and disruption, without the need to, without the need to earn a dollar, but truly to be able to be told for the sake of being told. And so we see that within the cultural space. We see that within the infrastructural and policy changes. We're calling on the FCC to do an audit of its anti-Black history. We're asking for a reparative fund to be given so that from the spectrums and airwaves, like Black news sources and entertainment sources can be fully funded. We're doing things such as Black Future Newsstand in Harlem, where we're taking headlines from the future, telling news stories and saying, how beautiful would this be if these were the new beats, yeah. If the possibilities were told versus all the problems. And so we're looking into doing more cultural and public installations like that.
Wonderful. And a website?
Media2070.org.
And Trevor, what would you like to for listeners and viewers to know about the work you do?
I'm the Director of Narrative Change at Liberation Ventures. Our mission is to accelerate the Black-led movement for racial repair, and we really see ourselves as a field builder supporting the reparations movement. So we do grant making, capacity building, and narrative change work. And so what I'm really focused on is kind of facilitating the growth of narrative power. And so really thinking about how can we increase the ability to tell stories that can shift mental models and cultural mindsets. So I'm really always looking out to bringing more artists and cultural makers into the movement. And so over the past year, I've been working with Venikia and other organizers in co-creating a narrative framework that we're calling the Narrative House. And hopefully this can be a tool for future storytelling and content creation and creative action. So my vision is really, how can we bring artists, those who hold individual narrative power, to work alongside the organizers who are building political power on the ground to shape a broader narrative throughout society. So artists and cultural makers, you know, hit us up.
And a website?
Liberationventures.org.
Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
I've been speaking with Venikia Williams, campaign manager of Media 2070, and Trevor Smith, director of narrative change at Liberation Ventures, during a recent conference on reparations in Atlanta, Georgia, produced for Yes Media, where I work as racial justice editor. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. You can access these and other interviews on our website, risingupwithsonali.com, by becoming a subscriber. Find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify, and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RUWithSonali. This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. Hundreds of movement leaders, activists, organizers, funders, and journalists gathered in Atlanta, Georgia in June 2023 at A Light, A Line, A Rise, an invitation-only conference on reparations organized by the Decolonizing Wealth Project. As the conference's media partner, Yes Media spoke with more than a dozen prominent organizers, activists, and leaders. Among them was Jessica Ann Mitchell Iwuyor, a multicultural communications specialist and the founder of the National Black Cultural Information Trust.
I'm Jessica Ann Mitchell Iwuyor. Most folks just call me Jam or Jam Iwuyor. I'm the founder of the National Black Cultural Information Trust. We share news, information, resources that uplifts the collective freedom of Black communities and also challenges cultural mis- and disinformation.
Well, we live at a time when information is so important and, is so easily accessible and informs the conversations around especially race and racial justice, and things move at lightning speed. Tell me whether you think overall the digital revolution has helped or hurt causes of racial justice, causes around reparations in particular.
I think it's definitely helped. It's given more access to voices that traditionally would be sidelined. We've seen the rise of Black Lives Matter. We've seen the rise of Me Too and various social justice movements. And they really probably wouldn't have spread as far if we hadn't had that digital revolution, that the accessibility, the ability for anyone to be able to pick up their cell phones and spread their message with the entire world.
So basically, historically excluded voices from traditional media created their own media.
Yes, they did. Created their own media, created their own platforms, built their own communities. So the digital space has been very important. Now, there are negatives. There's always a negative. Sometimes in the digital space, it is very easy to co-opt a message. It's easy to, become like a Trojan horse in a sense and start using a hashtag in a malicious way. Those things do happen. Some people create fake accounts pretending to be a part of a movement and then taking advantage of the situation to sway people one way or the other. Those things do happen. But overall, the digital space has been an advantage specifically to people of African descent who have not always been given the microphone, not always been elevated. We've been able to elevate and push ourselves out into the mainstream. Like, you're going to hear us. It's not going to be so easy to ignore what we have to say.
And then do you feel that that has been a big reason or one reason why there is increased attention to the issue of reparations now?
Definitely. It definitely has, especially with what we've seen over the last few years with George Floyd and more. There's been an ongoing conversation in the digital space on what happens to people of African descent in this country and what has always happened to us. And we know that that links back to the era of chattel slavery, Jim Crow, and all its current vestiges that currently affect us today. So I think it definitely has had an impact on the reparations movement and the ability to grow support and build strength behind it, especially in digital spaces.
What do reparations mean to you? I mean, it's a big word, it's a big concept, even if it might be sort of a straightforward concept. Is there, does, for example, the media owe reparations?
I think the media does owe reparations. I know there's an organization that tackles that. I think it's Media 2020.
2070.
Yeah. Oh, Media 2070, yeah. But I do think so. Ida B. Wells spent so much of her life trying to document the lynchings that happened to African Americans. And it was the Black newspapers that carried those stories. And most of the mainstream newspapers were not accurately covering what was going on in this country. And sometimes, and actually often, mainstream media would be used to create more racial animus towards African Americans. And so, yes, I do think media owes reparations. But for me, reparations means means repair. The root of it means to repair. And there have been so many harms that have been done to people of African descent since we've made it to these shores, since we've been brought here. And I think that it's going to take a lot to do restoration, to do repair. But it can happen. I think it can happen in our lifetime.
How do you talk about issues like reparations? Tell me about the way in which you've made a space for yourself, you know, in a manner that is becoming increasingly typical for people whose voices have historically been excluded.
Well, I have a very non-traditional background. I always wanted to tell our stories and, most importantly, know the history. So as an undergrad, I did something that my parents completely were like, what? I majored in not something that makes sense to most people. I majored in African World Studies. And then I got a master's in Pan-African Studies. But then I realized I wanted to really be able to reach our communities and tell our stories in an effective way. So I went back and got another master's in public relations. And I've merged those fields together, Africana Studies and Communications. And so what I've done is created a space and where we can tell the stories in a way that is effective, in a way that reaches people, in a way that people understand. I usually start with my own personal story. When I was a little girl, about 8 or 9 years old, my grandmother, Hattie Virginia Jones of Augusta, Georgia, sat down and told me our family story of how when she was a little girl, her mother and father, my great grandparents, had to escape off of a plantation from Warren, Georgia. This was the time of sharecropping, so slavery was over. But you couldn't really leave. If you were a sharecropper, people could go to jail. People could be killed for trying to escape off of those plantations. And that really meant a lot for her to tell me that story, because these are people that were alive when I was a little girl. My great-grandmother Flossie, my great-grandfather George, they gave me candy. I used to sit on their laps. They never told me any of that. You know, of course, they wouldn't tell a child the horrors they've been through. But when you grow up knowing, being able to touch, feel, understand, these are the people that we are fighting for their history and legacy. This is not something that happened a long time ago. That is my family. That is not some long distance story. That is now. I am their great granddaughter. I know these people. I know them. I am them. So I start with that story because one of the first things people say about reparations is, that was so long ago. Slavery was so long ago. Nobody owes you anything. Nobody. And I'm like, no, it's actually not that long ago. And Jim Crow is right there. It's not just about chattel slavery, even though that's a huge component of it, but Jim Crow is sitting right there in your face. You turn your head and there's Jim Crow, where your parents had to be bused into schools. It was yesterday, and the vestiges of it are today. So I start with those personal narratives and stories to really bring to light that the issue is current. It's also future. Just like what happened to my great-grandparents impacted me today, what happens to me today impacts my children and future generations. So reparations are not just past-looking, it's forward-looking. What do we want for the future of America? What do we want for the future of Black people in America and globally? Because if we don't make a change now, if we don't start restoring and repairing and doing the things that are needed to disentangle this beast, disentangle these systems that oppress us, what will the future look like? So I start with those personal narratives, those stories. I use a lot of our cultural understandings to really try to reach people in that way.
Do you think that there's a shift, that cultural shift that needs to happen in terms of collective responsibility? Because, you know, a conservative might listen to what you just said and think, well, people should lift themselves up by their bootstraps, and even if it was a few generations ago, et cetera, et cetera. We have this individualist mindset in this country, manifest destiny, et cetera. We all, you know, this myth that those who have made it to the top have done so on their own, and everyone else who hasn't done so has just personally failed or just not been good enough.
That is so funny when people say the whole lift yourself up. They never say the pilgrims should have lifted themselves up. They never say that. They never say that, you know, the enslavers, maybe they should have picked the cotton. Maybe they should have lifted themselves up. Why did they go and get my ancestors? Why did they go and take Native Americans' land? Why did they do all of those things? They never say that these people should have lifted themselves up. It's only when it comes to us, when we have literally lifted this nation up. So it is such a big myth that it's like, I don't even like playing into it, feeding into it, because that has never been the case with this country, that people just were lifted up on their own and strove on their own. The way that it even came to be was based off of the backs and blood of Native Americans and Africans. So I don't want to hear anything about lifting yourself up by the bootstraps. We've done everything that we could. And on top of that, when we created our own communities, when we were striving and doing all these things on ourselves, what happened? Those communities were attacked. They were bombed. They were all type. They, so many things were done by governments, local and nationally. So if we have to pull ourselves up by the bootstraps, why hasn't this nation done that? The nation couldn't even do it itself. So I just hate to even hear that argument. No. You know, it definitely does need to be a cultural change in how we look at even the founding of this nation, so that we can stop with that attitude that it was individuals that made it so, because that never happened.
And that's a huge reason why there are attacks on the teaching of history, because learning about how it really unfolded sheds light on exactly what you were just saying, right?
Yes. And that's one of the things we're also working on. We have a program called Project Protect Black History. And we are sending books to various places. We just participated in the Malcolm X Book Festival in Winter Park, Florida, sending thousands of dollars worth of books to the local community. And we're doing that in different spaces. But yes, that is part of it. When you don't teach the history, then people they are operating under a misconception. They think they know the full story and they don't. So it's very important to have that background. It's very important for our children to learn the history. It's very important for adults to relearn what we think we know about the founding of America, about chattel slavery, about Jim Crow, about all of it. Really, we really need an understanding of global history to truly even understand how this nation was founded and the systems of chattel slavery. But yes, once you minimize the history, it's kind of like being able to control the dialogue, thereby being able to control what people will support and control the either the momentum of a movement or the stagnation of a movement.
Where can people find you online and find out more about the work that you do?
For the National Black Cultural Information Trust, people can find us at nbcit.org and at nbcitrust on all social media.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
I've been speaking with Jessica Ann Mitchell Iwuyor, founder of the National Black Cultural Information Trust, during a recent conference on reparations in Atlanta, Georgia, produced for Yes Media, where I work as the racial justice editor. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. You can access this and other interviews on our website, risingupwithsonali.com, by becoming a subscriber. Find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify, and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RUWithSonali.
Rising Up with Sonali is hosted, written, and executive produced by Sonali Kohatkar. Anna Buss is the producer, technical director, and web and social media supervisor. Our theme music is by Grammy Award-winning band Kitsap. Like us on Facebook.com/RUWithSonali. That's the letters RU with Sonali. And follow us on twitter.com/RU with Sonali. Our website is risingupwithsonali.com, where you can find all our programs archived and where you can get direct access to all our video and audio files.
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
So, how much is that golden doodle or adorable Frenchie in the window? Probably a lot, especially in terms of suffering for its parents, who in many cases are living lives of misery in a puppy mill. On the next episode of Voices for the Animals, we'll be talking with Robert Hensley, senior counsel for the ASPCA, about their push to pass Goldie's Act, a bill now in Congress that would ensure better conditions and oversight for the hundreds of thousands of dogs now suffering at the hands of large-scale dog breeders.
The dog that Goldie's Act is named for was one of the dogs that lived in squalor and tragically was allowed to starve to death over several months while USDA inspectors observed her deteriorating condition but did nothing to help her.
That's on the next Voices for the Animals.